Welcome to the Real Sports Guys. We're real guys, talk real sport. Sorry we're getting a late start tonight. Marcus the Game Changer, the man that usually opens us up, sets us up like Chauncey Billups, is under the weather. But we got I got Ray in the house, and this is D. Wills back in the mix again. And Ray is on sabbatical, but he agreed to come and step in tonight for a little bit. Ray, how you feeling tonight?
Feeling pretty good. Tired, but good. I hope Marcus is feeling better.
Yeah, he called me tonight, sound like somebody was killing him. And I said, oh, my goodness, and we back up. But he did leave us with a full plate of things to talk about for tonight. You know, we got a lot, you know, in terms of the NBA and the NFL and all the labor. We got college hoop coming up. That we love to talk. And there's some things we're going to say for Marcus when he comes back to kind of get in. But, you know, as we look at, you know, we began talking a little bit about, you know, the trade deadline and what was going on, you know, last week. We had a chance to see, you know, when people are talking about the trade, I love to evaluate when people talk about the trade, particularly the New York trade, and everybody focused so much on Carmelo, and obviously he's the big piece in this trade, and he was driving all the conversation. But when I learned that Chauncey Billups was going to be part of that package, and then, you know, it's funny because people are talking about, you know, the next phase is to get Chris Paul, as though, you know, Chauncey was like this side dish that didn't bring anything. And I basically was saying that, you know, Chauncey is the reason why Carmelo is going to be successful right away. Because this is a guy that's going to know where he wants to get shots on the floor. He's going to be able to get people involved. He's going to have a defensive presence. But the biggest thing is he knows when there's a big moment. This guy's an incredible leader. And to see that performance in Miami, I don't know if you had a chance to see it the other night, but I just went crazy because I'm a Chauncey fan, and I don't think he gets enough love for being a elite guard. You know, even when he was at the Pistons, it was clear he was an elite guard. People are always trying to rank other folks over him, and all he does is win. So I was really happy to see him have that big moment. You know, it's still early, but he put his signature right on that game and the success of this team. And the thing about it is I think the management of the Knicks, some of those key guys, they understood Chauncey. You know, they let everybody talk about Carmelo, but they understood what Chauncey would bring to the team and that, you know, he was a really key piece to kind of getting this thing right. You can talk about Chris Paul, but Chris Paul don't have those big moments. He don't have what Chauncey brings to the table, and Chauncey still got a lot in the tank. So I don't know if you had a chance and you want to comment on that, but that part of the trade. But, Ray, I'd like to hear what you have to say.
Well, that was the part of the trade that I didn't understand. You know, I realized that New York, you know, asking for Melo just seemed like an awful lot. But when they got Billups along with that trade, I thought it was a coup. And I wondered what Denver, you know, I was kind of happy for Denver for at least, you know, not getting into one of those decision type things where, you know, they just ended up empty. But when you know, they make a trade, they get some players back, you know, certainly a better situation than what Cleveland found themselves in. But when they gave up Billups, then I didn't understand the trade because, you know, those two, you know, were probably, you know, the rhyme and reason for the success in Denver. And Denver could find themselves, you know, like, you know, very, you know, Cleveland Cavaliers like now.
Yeah.
They've got a huge rebuilding effort now. You know, at least, and I just didn't understand that part of the trade. I don't know that I would have given up Billups and Melo. But it certainly put New York in a great light. You know, the fans in New York should just be tickled that they were able to come away with so much.
Yeah, I think that, you know, when you think about, you know, what, you know, Denver's built some depth. And if you think about a team that's got to give up an all-star, Denver was able to really, I think they got a lot out of it. You know, as you look at
they did.
You never get, you know, it's hard to replace a Carmelo or a LeBron. But as I said last week, Dever did as well as you could do when you're giving up a player like that. And so that's something that I kind of commend them on. But I'm surprised that they were able to give up Chauncey for that. And if you're going to bring a lot of young players in, you know, to have a veteran like that to kind of – I mean, it's good for Chauncey because he gets to compete, you know, at a high level for something. But to, you know, I think they got out of it as much as you could probably get out of it. And I think moving forward, George Karl was pretty happy with that.
And I think that, you know, perhaps Billups was instrumental in being a part of the trade. You know, I don't think that he sat back, the players in Cleveland. Mm-hmm. And all they can do is be upset that they're still there,
mm-hmm.
you know. So when you look at what Chauncey actually got out of it, you know, that was kind of incredible.
Yeah, and the other thing that kind of came up, you know, through the trade that I think was interesting when you look at this whole idea of whether or not they can play defense, and I think what Chauncey adds to it is that, you know, Chauncey puts a lot of emphasis on defense, and he's the kind of person that can really get people like Carmelo and those guys to commit on the defensive end because he comes with that kind of cachet.
Right.
And I think that's an important piece that he also brings to it. You know, even if D'Antoni isn't really emphasizing defense, Chauncey,
right,
through his leadership, will get those guys in the right place.
Well, it'll certainly get back. I mean, he's not going to be the only one that gets back. And that's the beauty of it, is that they'll follow him. And he has that veteran, you know, flavor. Mm-hmm. You know, they will have to follow him. He's not going to be the only one, you know, dashing back down court to make a stop, especially when the games get tight.
Mm-hmm.
You know, at least you have somebody out there now that can holler and, you know, can remind them, you know, that they can't rest on their laurels. They can't just go down there and get a quick score and then trot back. Because some of these teams, you know, Boston or Miami, you know, are going to get back on you. You know, they're going to inbound that ball. They're going to head back down court. Chauncey's going to be there. He's going to be yelling, you know, come on, get back.
That's right. And
they're going to listen. You know, he's a veteran. They're going to listen.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, he brings a lot of cachet to it. And he's like that coach on the floor. The other thing that I thought was a really good move and that was kind of a subtle move, and it's not going to change the balance of the West, but, you know, a couple of teams are going to have an impact on seeding on the West. So they might not win the championship, but if you think about Gerald Wallace going to Portland or Landry going to New Orleans, these aren't picks that make them instant contenders. But what it does is they gel going down the stretch, and some of these elite teams and some, you know, Lakers and San Antonio and Dallas and some of these teams are jockeying for a position to have to play these teams who are a little bit stronger. Can impact what the seeding is going to be. And I think that's what's, you know, really interesting about that, those moves. And I think those are the moves that people have to pay attention to because they end up impact seeding. Because, you know, if you got to play New Orleans and you got to go play Portland or you got to play and they get a little bit better, you know, and they're beginning to cash up for get ready for next year, you know, that might impact, you know, who ends up with the number one seed out West.
Well, I think Gerald Wallace in Portland, you know, kind of negates what might happen if Brandon Roy isn't there this year.
That's right.
And is it going to be that long-term, you know, fix for replacing a superstar like Brandon Roy? But you get a chance to at least, you know, ante up now. You know, if Brandon Roy can't play as many minutes or he can't, you know, contribute like you would have liked him to, you know, LaMarcus Aldridge is playing well. You know, they they now have added the depth that they certainly needed, you know, to make them. You know, they're not a pushover now. You're going to have to take them a game or two farther than you would have if Brandon Roy didn't show up for a night or couldn't play. And it gives and it takes the pressure off of him in thinking that he has to come back for 35, 40 minutes a game. Because now he can contribute, you know, as well as he can contribute, as long as he can contribute, knowing that there's still guys on the court that can score. You know, they did some pretty, you know, remarkable things this year without him. You know, given the makeup of that team, and you know, they certainly, you know, other guys just stepped up. LaMarcus Aldridge stepped up crazy.
Yeah,
and has been playing really well. And now he has the confidence, you know, to go out and play, you know, against the Lakers, against San Antonio, against these teams that, you know, he could have cashed it in. He could have said, I can't do it by myself. But he just stepped up and played.
That's where like Aldridge, you know, like you said, rising to that occasion, demonstrating that leadership, allowing for a GM to kind of rethink, you know, where that franchise can go, where they can re-up and kind of not miss a beat, not really drop off. I mean, that's going to be important. A couple of the other moves, you know, everybody was trying to figure out what the Celtics were doing. And, you know, and obviously Danny Ainge was saying, you know, we're not going to let Perkins go in the summer for nothing because we're not going to sign in for what he wants. And we have to figure out how to get younger. Yeah, we got a little smaller, but we got a little more versatile. And figure out how to still make our run for the championship, which is the toughest thing to do when you know they could have kept Perkins and made a run for the championship, but then they would have lost him in the summer because they weren't going to pay him. So,
sure. Or, did you see the move that Boston made tonight?
I wanted to kind of get that in because I think the next phase is I want to get to the buyout part, which is a whole set of folks on the buyout part of it is, but it sets up Oklahoma City, you know, who didn't have an inside presence at all, to begin, you know, building a very strong inside presence there, which is incredible, you know, getting some size.
Well, and it's something that they absolutely had to do. You know, they've been a good ball team, but they didn't have enough inside presence to truly be, you know, competitive. This, you know, what's funny is that some of these trades, you know, dramatically alter what success some of these teams have already had.
Mm-hmm.
You know, getting Perkins in Oklahoma is huge.
Yeah.
You know, because now it's certainly filling needs just before the playoffs. And so what teams were looking at them is, you know, okay, this is how we're going to beat them on this night. Perkins changes that, not so dramatically, you know, that he's an absolute superstar. But now all of a sudden you've got this big guy in the middle.
Yeah.
You know, and he wasn't there the last time they played, you know. So some of these teams have to, you know, step up and play them differently. They get to practice a few games. They get to gel a little bit. And Perkins' game isn't you're not going to have to adapt so much to it. He simply adds. You don't have to, like, insert him in and try to get him into the flow. He's just a big man in the middle. He's blocking shots. He's grabbing rebounds. He's kicking it out. And then, he's scoring in the paint. You know, it's not like a guy that you have to figure out his timing or anything else. It's just, he's that present. So they're going to be able to use him immediately. He can step in and play right away. You don't have to figure him out.
And he defends Paul Gasol as well as anyone. So I know
that's right.
You know, Paul looking to have to go up against him, you know, against a team that they had their hands full with, you know, last year is going to be interesting dynamic, strengthen their defense. It's going to be a battle out there. I was going to ask you a question. I mean, what do you think about the whole Deron Williams in Utah? And, you know, Deron, which was a surprise trade. I mean, no one saw that coming.
And that was one of those, they didn't get better. I don't think they got better. Mm-hmm. And I think that after Sloan left, you know, was this payback? Was this, you know, did they feel that the fan base wasn't going to be behind him, or, you know, he wasn't going to fill seats, or, you know, was that something that, you know, that Sloan was trying to tell him that this isn't something we can build around, so if this is what you have, then I'm going to go. You know, that you know, for what used to be, because of the stability they had in coaching, you know, a pretty decent program, now you wonder where that program is headed.
Yeah.
And when they lose a piece like Duran, then you just have to throw your hands up and go, I really don't know what they're going to have now or in the near future. You know, you don't really realize what they're going to look like.
Well, I you know, when I looked at this, I took on the Ray philosophy to selecting teams in the NCAA tournament.
Sure.
I remember years ago you said, and this is when my guy Devin Harris, and that was on that Wisconsin team. I think they went out and played at Utah. And you're like, you better select the Wisconsin, because, you know, these cats they've been up in Madison. They haven't been in the city. And,
right.
You know, playing in Utah ain't nothing but like playing in the coast center. And,
I remember they were playing Jason Kidd and
they're playing somebody who's, these guys, you know, are coming from Urban, have been around. I don't know if it was whatever it was, but
right.
You know, I think getting a guy like Devin Harris, who is hungry to kind of plant his seed, I think they made this move on, we need to get a kind of guy that's going to be able to grow and be in Utah, you know, and a guy like Devin Devin's trying to make it, you know, he's doing well.
Not only is he trying to make it, Devin here is more like Karl Malone than Deron Williams ever will be.
That's right.
And when you got to have your fan base stack up behind somebody, the folks in Utah are going to stack up and be behind a guy like Devin Harris before, you know, after. I say, you don't know what phone calls were made. You don't know how fans were reacting.
Yeah.
You know, when Sloan left, he's like the savior, you know.
Right.
And if there was any thought from that fan base that it was Williams' fault that he left,
yeah.
And both of them said that really wasn't the deciding factor. You know, both of them said that, and I'm sure Karl Malone and Sloan didn't always agree. And you know, that's just the way the game is played. But it almost seemed like Williams chased him out.
Yeah.
He just couldn't get him, you know, to fit that mold. And so Sloan just threw his hands up after so many years and said, I'm done.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just wondering if the fans didn't just turn on him, you know, if they ever would have followed him and believed in him, you know, the way they would have had Jerry Sloan stayed there.
Yeah, and I think that was all a part of it, realizing that, you know, there's going to be so much pressure on Deron Williams to win and, you know,
yep.
Whether or not they could keep him through the free agency because, you know, he doesn't want to be viewed that way. I think they made a decision kind of like the Celtics, you know, and like, you know, let's preempt this. And what it is, and I was saying this to I think to Marcus, is that, because I had been telling him about it, I said, you know, there are certain small market organizations that have a philosophy, whether it's across all kinds of sports, and they just hold to it, and that's why they sustain at a high level. For they make those decisions because they know who they are.
And right.
This has much to do about why Utah has always been good for the past 20 years. It wasn't just a Jerry Sloan thing, but they have a philosophy. You know, they were doing that with Layden before Sloan.
Right.
They had it. You know, they were winning for a while, and part of it is they decided on a philosophy similar to a Pittsburgh Steelers or
mm-hmm.
a certain small market organization, how and the kind of player and style they're going to need to play to leverage to win. And
right.
This was along the lines of their philosophy. And
sure.
And what they ended up doing is still get back the kind of value that can continue to make things, you know. And they saw some things free up. You started to see some of the other players play a little bit better, you know, because Sloan was not riding this much. AK-47 looked like he was lost in Siberia before. Now he's had a couple of good games, you know.
Right.
So he looked like he's had, you know, so, and I know they crashed, bash heads a little bit. So, but it was the kind of decision that I was surprised. It was surprised that they made it so quickly. But as I thought about it, it's what I think a Utah would do.
Right, and again, going back to, you know, what gels with that arena and that fan base. You know, Utah is only going to sell so many tickets, rather than in the playoffs. I mean, they're a small market team, but they still sell out their place. You know, and if they have a team on the court that the fans can get behind and rally behind, you know, they'll still sell those tickets. And I think what they may have saw was that, again, you know, it's like, hell, if Jerry don't want you, we don't want you either. And I'm not, you know, and the only way that they can say that is by not going to the game.
Yeah.
So,
well, one of the things, I wanted to kind of set the table with, you know, trade deadline. But then this other phase that we didn't hear a lot about prior to the trade deadline, because Carmelo dominated so much of it, but this whole idea of a buyout, which was never really as much. I mean, I think this, you know, this always happened, but it never was, I think, something that was as visible. And I think what really brought some visibility to it was the Perkins trade. And the idea that they felt like they could get some value back, Boston, through the buyout, which ended up happening. You know, they end up getting Murphy, who, you know, had a choice between them and Miami and chose to go to Boston, which from a playing standpoint, in terms of playing time, I think he would have been a more featured player in Miami. But I think he understood, you know, his chance to win right now, you know, coming into Boston was good. And then you have Bibby going to Miami.
Right.
Which is an interesting move on whether that's going to play out or not for Miami. It definitely gives him an upgrade at the point guard, you know, but is it enough of an upgrade? He's not really a defensive upgrade in terms of defending a Chauncey, but he's a good upgrade in terms of the offense.
I think what Danny Ainge looked at with Troy Murphy is his ability to play away from the basket. You know, he still gets rebounds on the other end. He's still a big man. But what killed Boston in that Lakers series was the fact that they didn't have a big body in the paint when they needed it.
Yeah.
And so I think what you're going to see, I think that was with, you know, with the Lakers in mind. I think that they feel that in a five game or a seven game series, they're going to get out of Miami.
Yeah.
But without a Troy Murphy, they're not going to get out of L.A. And I say that because Murphy's not going to be – he's going to be that defensive presence that you want in the paint. He's going to be big enough, you know, to be in there and make a difference. Pau Gasol is not going to go straight up the middle like he did when Perkins wasn't in the game. But now when you get him on the other end of the court where you want a guy grabbing rebounds or shooting in the paint, either he's going to be effective – or he's going to slide to the outside, and he's going to pull those bigs out there. Because if you don't go out on him, he's going to shoot.
And I think what it, I agree with you. I think what it gives them is that the year they won the championship, they had so much flexibility. So many, you talk about Poe, all these, they had so much flexibility and so many interchangeable parts that they could do. But the other thing about this move, I think you hit right on it, but it also conserves both O'Neals. So.
Right.
You don't have to put so much pressure on them. So when you're in the Lakers series, and in the last 5 minutes, you've been able to stay in it, you can now insert either one of those O'Neals who might only have three or four fouls at that time, and they could be real aggressive on the glass, on the defense and offensive end, because they're not in foul trouble because you had to play the size because you didn't have a guy like Troy Murphy and these other players to put in. So they really allow you to manage
that,
the fourth quarter.
I think what that does is it creates a situation where that big defender on that opposing team is going to be tired.
Yeah.
Because if you had a bang with the O'Neals underneath for two quarters and then chase this other white guy around who doesn't go into the paint that much, who's out there waving his hand, and you got to fly out there to stop that three. You know, it creates a bad situation. These other teams may try to go small. These other, might try to, and then all of a sudden you're just slipping back into the paint and run your offense in another way and just have him grab rebounds. It gives them, like you say, it gives them the ultimate flexibility because they can bang with you now and they can, have your big man running, all around the court. And who else has that? Who else has that luxury? But that's that Boston mentality. Boston has Boston's most best success has been with adequate big guys,
uh-huh.
but not necessarily superstar big guys.
Uh-huh.
They're beating you, 2, 3, and 4.
Yes.
Now that Rondo is such a superb ball player, they really now it's 1, 2, 3, and 4,
uh-huh.
and their big guy, they're creating havoc by making those, bigs play a whole different ballgame.
Yeah, and I agree on that. And Evelyn, look, I'm looking forward to see how Doc makes this all come together. I was gonna ask you a question. Did you see the labor strike in Big D in Detroit when the folks were furious to come to the shooting?
See, when I read about it, I could only laugh because it wasn't Stucky. I think he's the only one that commented, and said, "Yeah, it was, it was a bad thing to do, and I won't ever do it again." The other guys were like, why we did it, and what they missed was a shoot around. Granted, it wasn't, and so he didn't play any of them, and. He didn't get that from the front office.
Mm-hmm.
I can't see him calling upstairs and going, these guys didn't make a shoot around them, we'll bench all of them. So it's like, you know what's going to happen up in Detroit. He's gone. They might have a whole revamp. They might lose a couple of those guys. They tried to trade Rip. You don't know what's going to happen, but in Detroit's going to look a whole lot different next year. They will not come out like this again. This is kind of like a George Karl situation where he's just done.
Yeah.
No matter how bad the players look in doing what they did, it's the coach that ultimately is going to go.
Yeah.
And, I give him credit, for having having the balls to do it. It just shows you that, he does have some principles, because when the guys don't show up for the shoot around, they shouldn't play. But, I'm sure upstairs they're asking, well, how come the guys don't make it to the shoot around? Well, they're fed up. You don't hear anything like a vote of no confidence in the NBA like that. But, it was.
And one of the things I'm wondering about, this is, Joe Dumars, who I had a lot of admiration for as a player in his early days as a GM. He missed, obviously, on Carmelo and Darko. But, he hit on some other things and really put together a good team for a championship run. When you think about how he's handled the coach selections since Brown, and some of the trades, they still should have Chauncey. There's certain things, there's certain pieces that you just hold on to. You would have been better off moving Rip or somebody if you could have.
Right.
I don't know how those circumstances work out, but just when you look at how wheels are falling off ever since Chauncey left the team, really, but just the whole coaching, how he handled Wimp, Sanders, it tells you that, going to the finals 3 or 4 years in a row isn't all bad. I think that's what Utah gets right sometimes. I know we Detroit won a championship, but Sanders at least had them competitive and going to the finals and being competitive. And then you bring in a young coach after that. They bring in a young coach with a veteran squad without moving some pieces around to allow that coach to be successful. Then they got to get rid of that coach. And then they bring this coach in, and it just doesn't seem like a plan. And you cleared your whole thing of moving Chauncey in was a clear cap space so you could position for the LeBron chase. But then you go and you get Venezuela and you sign my guy from Chicago and you sign all these folks on the squad, so you eat up that cap space. And then, you know, so that it doesn't seem like when early on he had a real clear plan. And
right.
Then on top of it, now I'm looking over at Minnesota and you got Bill Laimbeer coaching Kevin Love.
Right.
Why isn't Bill
right.
Laimbeer coaching in Detroit? You
right.
know, you know, I said this early on. I said when Bill was coaching the Shock, I was like, Bill should be the coach. He's going to get you back on to be the Pistons, being the Pistons. So
right.
now he's going to get this assistant coach. You need to be bringing Laimbeer back and get that identity. And so it's just like, it seems like, you know, with this new ownership going in, is Dumars in jeopardy?
Well, that's the thing, you know. I think that was part of it. When you had that new ownership and they started moving that different, you know, the Darko, you know, situation for Dumars. If you remember back, you know, yes, he brought hindsight being 2020, he should have went after Melo, but
everybody was high on Darko. I mean, he had
exactly,
yeah, I mean,
exactly,
and you know,
everybody saw him that
you didn't want to even walk.
Exactly. I mean, he was supposed to be that guy, and it just never happened. And at the time, it was one of those things that they were winning so well. Having another player like Carmelo Anthony wasn't what they really needed. If they could get this big guy, they could have been a dynasty for years.
Yeah.
To come, and it didn't happen. So throw that out. I think that's, you know, we aren't going to talk about that as Dumars' downfall because that's long past. I think what's happened today is that Detroit wants to move. The ownership wants to move in a new direction, and they should have cleaned house completely. Dumars could have gone somewhere else and had success somewhere else, perhaps. But they didn't really retool. They just tried to keep that same, you know, bunch of guys together, and then they kept them together for too long, and now they're just piecemealing them out. And now they are 3 years behind, you know, perhaps even 4 years behind in the rebuilding that they should have been doing. You know, nobody's going to win a championship with Rip. You know, nobody's going to win a champ. You know, even Billups when they traded him, you know, when they lost him. You know, that should have been the sign. They should have said, okay, we aren't going to be very good for very well, you know, for a while.
Yeah.
But they don't seem to be going in the right direction, and that's not really been – that really hasn't been Dumars' forte anyway.
Yeah.
You know?
And part of it is, you know, you got to solidify – you got to really get a coach that can help you build around this. And you got to have somebody you have a shared philosophy around. And – you can't come out of the Wimp Sanders and start and make mistakes from there. At some point, if you're gonna have these young guys, you got to get somebody to work with leadership.
That's the other problem, D. Is that when they went to Sanders, I didn't like that, you know, because when they lost Brown. You know, Brown was always one of those coaches that every team that had young players on tried to bring in because he could help develop those young players and make those teams successful. And then all of a sudden it would get to a point with Brown that he started, the players were old enough to question it, it seemed like. And then he didn't have success, and then they bring in an older coach, a coach more attuned to, you know, coaching veterans and dealing with those egos. Somebody that would look somebody in the eye and go, just play.
Yeah.
Just shut up and play, you know. And Sanders wasn't that guy.
Yeah.
And you know, and that's kind of the downfall. You know, they went, you know, in a completely different direction than what they should have after they lost Brown.
And that's when I said, that's when you roll the dice and, you know, and you pull it like the Lakers did when they went to Riley. You pull a cat out of nowhere. That's where you go with the Laimbeer.
That's right. Exactly. Right now they're in a place that they really need to almost completely rebuild.
Yeah.
And a coach like Laimbeer, you know, is the legacy.
Yep.
You know, he can at least, you know, you would think that he could at least put together a team that would have, you know, the philosophy that he had. And you can win without having, you know, five superstars on the floor if they'll buy into it.
That's right.
You know, they'll buy into it. They didn't have five superstars on the floor when he was winning championships.
Right.
You know, they had some great players. They had a couple, you know, when you know, like we always talk about, when you start picking, you know, the best of all times, you know, that those teams after Isaiah and Dumars, then it starts to get a little bit thinner. And then they had guys like Rodman, who, you know, are one of a kind, and Laimbeer, who are one of a kind.
Uh-huh.
Now John Sally, he got, you know, Detroit got more out of John Sally than anybody else would have got out of him.
That's right.
You know, and the same can be said for Laimbeer. Now Rodman, he had success with Chicago, and Dumars and Isaiah could have played anywhere. But I mean, it was just a whole different mindset, whole different, you know. But they were successful as hell. They had, you know, they knew who they were. They played as well as, you know, as they could.
And I think that's, you know, part of, you know, what, you know, they're gonna have to do is just really around. It's good when they're good. You know, particularly if Chicago is better, that rivalry can be rekindled a little bit. When you start thinking about MVP candidates here around the middle of the season, who are you thinking about as MVP candidate?
You know, I hate to say this, but I think LeBron. All right, mm-hmm. right now when you talk about, because to me that MVP is also going to be that person that could lead his team to a championship. You could say the same thing about Paul Pierce, but I think LeBron, you know, and everybody, you know, might say, well, he should be where he's at, you know, after all that, you know, he did. But some of that, you also got to say, you know, after all he's been through, for them to be where they're at, and he's the key figure in that whole piece, you know, I think LeBron James is certainly an MVP candidate.
Yeah, I would, say that LeBron is. I like Derrick Rose.
If you just go, Derrick Rose is one of those players that without Derrick Rose, Chicago would not be at all as successful as they've been. He is certainly the key, the key to that whole franchise's success. But rather than not, Chicago will continue, you know, that kind of play in the playoffs and how far they'll go. You know, they're playing very well, but they could go out early, you know, in the playoffs. So,
and the reason why I say that is that he, with the injury to Noah and all these things, and they're still playing at a high level, they might end up with, you know, they could end up with the number one,
number one seed.
Best
record in the league. They certainly could, you know, but it's, you know, when I look at the East, you know, I don't see Chicago being, you know, I don't see Chicago coming out of the East to play for the championship.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because I think that these other teams, and it's nothing against Rose, it's just that these other teams have better, you know, have better makeups,
mm-hmm.
and are built better to go into those 5 and 7 game series,
mm-hmm.
than Chicago will be. And I may be totally wrong. You know, the thing about it, when you got a young player like that, is that he can actually step it up.
Oh yeah,
you don't know what he'll do in the playoffs.
That's right.
After all the hard work that he's done, you know, he certainly might not be ready to give it up in the playoffs. So,
well,
I mean, he's capable of just completely taking over.
And he's you know, I mean, what he's done a good job of is he's extended his game. His outside shot is more consistent.
Yeah.
You know, but he just has lifted. I mean, if you take, you know, major players like he's had out of his lineup, you expect they would fall off.
And right.
They're in a hunt. That, a lot of that has to do with the fact that he's just been killing folks. You know, I think that.
You don't want to make the comparison with Jordan, you know, because Jordan made a lot of people look foolish in the playoffs.
Mm-hmm.
But Rose has been doing, you know, very similar stuff,
mm-hmm.
you know. And you know, just when you win, when you start hitting them game-winning shots, when you start feeling like that,
mm-hmm.
that's when these young guys really bloom and transcend just regular old stardom.
Yeah.
And he has that opportunity, and you can't, you know, I used to bet against Jordan, you know, in those Boston series, you know. But you also knew it was just a matter of time. It's just a matter of time.
Yes.
Young men like that hate losing. They just hate it. And then all of a sudden, the fourth quarter rolls around. And it might not happen this year, but you can bet that it's going to happen. Where he just says, you know, fourth quarter rolls around and it's all him. It's all about him. You know, he's going to want every shot. And we'll see. You know, we'll see if he can do it.
Uh-huh. Well, we hitting this basketball pretty tough. I want to move to our wanted to hit a little bit of NFL as we're looking at combine, looking at the potential lockout, potential decertification. You know, kind of what's happening there. I don't know where you want to start with it.
I do like the fact that they stayed in negotiations for as long as they did.
Yeah.
But everything that you hear coming out of that is that they never really agreed on any key issues. You know, that they are still worlds apart on some of the major stumbling blocks. Both sides, I think, are just waiting for the other side to blink. You know, it's funny the other day that they were talking. You know, neither side of this fight is going to miss a car payment. You know, nobody's gonna miss a meal. You know, they all. You know, it's hard to, you know, for the average fan just to sit there and just. You know, just really feel for these guys because, you know, the billionaire owners are crying that they're not getting enough money and the millionaire players. But a couple of things that I did hear last week and had to think about, you know, they weren't my thoughts, but once you heard them, you had to remember that, you know, that NFL is the NFL. And one of the things that I heard that I just started to chuckle, I'm like, yeah, that's right. You know, not one owner, you can't name me one owner that ever made a difference on that field. You have never turned into a football game to watch them put the cameras up in the box and show you the owner. That's not why you watch football. That's not what you care about. Not one of those owners have ever made a team better.
I would argue against that. And what I would argue is, good owners create the context for continued winning. I think and the philosophy that they're at Green Bay and the leadership they have there, you don't come to watch them, but what they do when they're good is they consistently make the kind of moves that make what you watch enjoyable.
Okay.
So,
but when you talk about dividing up 30, you know, between 32 owners, when you start talking about dividing up $1 billion.
Oh, the money. Your comment is different than how I feel about the money.
Right. But what I'm saying is,
that's still not enough for you to ask for another billion, though.
Yeah, the sticking point, you know, the owners don't deserve that kind of a raise for the product that's on the field. The product that's on the field is truly the players.
Yeah. There's nothing that tells me why the business model has to change.
Right. Right.
There's nothing, with all the stuff they're saying, first of all, most of your stadiums are supported by public funding if you're a good business person, which a lot of these stadiums are. And I know you're in, you know, these folks don't, they're not those kind of owners by losing money. They always win. So, I mean, for the most part, they win. And so,
right.
I mean, they haven't made a business case for me. The case that I accept is two things I accept that they have about this. We got to find, just on principle, you got to come on a rookie scale. You can't be paying all these cats all this money who have never performed and not have money to pay for these bets that you need to be paying to do that. That part, I do think they need a rookie scale because it's just not, you know, you can't have a kid come in making a bonus as much as Peyton Manning. You just that's just not a good, for me, that's something wrong with the model. They still haven't made a good argument for the 18 games.
No.
In a way that makes sense for me. I could see additional rounds in the playoffs that would add some value to it. But there isn't a good, you know, that to me that's greed right there. And so the owners got all the power because they, you know, they can hold out longer than the players. But,
right.
But they don't have, they're not on the high ground in terms of the argument.
No. And then, you know, if you look at what the owners talk about, like the salary cap, you know, the players are for a salary cap. Mm-hmm. They understand that. And their pitch on the salary cap is that, you know, you're spending roughly, you know, $500 million on these rookies. And if you change that, instead of giving them $500 million, and you took $250 million, and that's what the cap would be, and then you take another, you know, $100 million, and you give it to the veteran, the retired players.
Yeah.
That's what the players are saying. You know, when you divide this up, you know, then you make sure that the rookies are getting paid. They have to get paid, and they have to get paid well.
Yep.
And you put money aside for the veteran players, and then put money aside for the retired players.
Yep.
And that's how you come up with that salary cap, and everybody be happy.
Yep.
The owners, they want to do something similar. They say, well, yeah, let's you know, cap the rookies at $250 million or $200 million. And then we'll put, you know, $100 million aside for, you know, the retired players, and then we'll take that other $100 million. Us owners, we'll take that. And they ain't playing nothing. They, you know, they aren't advancing. You know, they're just putting more money in their pocket. They're asking for.
Well, it sounds like we. We got cut off with Ray. We're going to try and pull him. It looks like he's coming back on here. We've got to. Hey, Ray, you there?
I'm here.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
The point I was making is that
the owners don't want to, you know, they don't mind the salary cap, but they want part of it.
Mm-hmm.
They want part of it. You know, they want to say that they're so far in debt that they want $1 billion and they want some of the salary cap money.
Yeah.
And, you know, the NFL has some things that they need to fix. The players seem to be willing to help them fix it, even if it's at the cost of selling out those rookies.
And everybody can agree that, you know, that those rookies have, for years have been overpaid. You know what I, you know, but
some of them rookies have been paid overpaid. Some of those 3-year contracts are way too large. But the other statistics that I heard, you know, recently were just shocking to me, and some of that I do blame on the NFL. You know, the fact that the average career is only about 3.5 years.
Yeah.
Well, if those players aren't producing, the NFL isn't keeping them around anyway. You know, if these players get hurt, you know, they're all underplaying this, the NFL's simply going to cut them.
What I would build in with that, if you're going to lower it, then we have guaranteed contracts for those cats for their first couple of years, something like that. That allows to settle for, you know, to address those, the fact that the careers are so short.
You know, they could still spend that $500 million if those rookies sign contracts that are incentive laden and have the opportunity to make the kind of money that the players last year made, then I don't have a problem with it.
Yeah.
And if that means setting aside $500 million and offering it up, you know, as a bonus situation so that those players can have the opportunity to make that kind of money, then it's a good deal. And then if they don't pay out that bonus money, go back to the veteran players and pay them, you know, incentive, you know, laden their contracts. And if there's anything left over, pay that retirement money. You know, if the players are going to be asked to give up the kind of money they're asked to give up, then the owner shouldn't ask for any of that $500 million back.
Yeah.
So the two statistics that bothered me were one was that, you know, the average career being about 3.5 years long. That's average, and that's a terrible average. And so you can understand why rookies would try to get that guaranteed money if they played at college at the level that they were playing at. The second thing that bothered me, and I blame the NFL for this, for not being more proactive in helping these young players keep their money, is that 78% of all players in the NFL will be broke 2 years after they leave the game. 78%. 8 out of 10. Whatever money they made in the NFL will be gone 2 years after their career is over. And so regardless of what money they do make, they're not being trained and taught and educated in how to handle that money.
Well, because if you think about it, if you're only average in the league 3 years, so
right.
Everybody thinks they're going to be in the league 15. So you buy in up front, like, this is a long-term career, right?
Sure.
And so
right.
You are overextended right out the gate, and your career is done in 2 years, and you still have those bills, but you don't have the contract. I mean, the system is going to increase it more for the NFL maybe than the NBA or baseball or anything else, because I bet you those average careers are a little bit longer, allows
right.
for just when you make some mistakes as a young person coming out the gate, buying more cars than you need to or buying a house you didn't need to buy. You have a little bit more time probably to recover from those mistakes than the NFL player if you're only going to be there 3 years and you already made major purchases. You know what do you do with that? I mean, I think
my suggestion is, if you understand that phenomenon, when you get a player that signs that 3-year contract with that $75 million guarantee, maybe you help yourselves as an owner by saying that kind of guaranteed money is going to come over 25 years.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to find yourself with an annuity. I'm going to pay you that over the course of your life, not just in the next 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to make sure, because the other side of that is that that's exactly how the older players, the retired players, those without pensions, have found themselves, and the NFL can find themselves out of that predicament if they start making these players, a little bit less rich immediately and a little bit more rich over the long haul.
Mm.
And come up with some type of a model that would afford them the opportunity, even if the minimum is 300, I think the minimum is like $375,000 a year. So at the end of 3 years, you still haven't made $1 million. It's not surprising that you're broke within 2 years. But if you were forced to bank that money, or if you weren't going to get that money, you know, paid out like that, and you were given that over a more lengthy period of time, maybe you start setting it up where, you know, if you, your first million is going to last you 10 years, whether you like it or not. I mean, if you want to sell it to one of those places on TV that say, you know, if you win the lottery, you got an insurance claim coming, we'll help you out. We'll give it to you all at once. If an NFL player does that, then maybe the NFL isn't going to be obligated to do anything for him for being so stupid. But they need to do something for these young. They need to do something for these young people to not be, you know, broke and broken up after a 10-year career.
Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, the sense is this isn't going to end well. You know, if the league, the union is going to decertify, it's going to end up in the courts. And my philosophy is sometimes that's where it needs to go to right the ship. You know, if people don't act right, then maybe that's where it needs to go to right the ship. And it's impacting things like, you know, the combine and the draft. You got some interesting performances happening. I don't know if you've been following the camp stuff. You know, he's some up mixed reviews in terms of how he performed in terms of the passing drills and stuff like that.
You know, they dubbed him on his interviews. You know,
but I always think that. Yeah, the closer you get to this stuff, he's still going to be at the top.
He has to be. You know, you don't win the national championship and play as well as he did last year without having, you know, without having, you know, the scouts notice.
Yep. But you know, you saw some, you know, a guy like J.J. Watt. I was looking at the defensive line, the top folks in all the different drills. J.J. Watt was up there in a lot of stuff: broad jump, high jump. In some of the speed, I mean, he's going to be a steal in terms of whoever gets him. I mean, they're predicting that he's going to go. I think on this one, Scout Inc. got him going 23rd overall. You know, you see some of these guys, these D linemen, you know, Fairley and Bowers and. I mean, there's going to be some. Peterson, I think, ran a 4.3 in a combine. They had a kid from Oregon. I can't remember his name. They weighed bench for like close to 225 pounds, like 40-something times.
Right.
You know, there's some incredible. But I keep thinking about the kid from Boston College years ago that had a great combine workout. And just, was it Manola? I'm probably going to somebody going to call in and give it to me right. But, you know, he became a high draft choice, and I think he went to Philadelphia and then didn't do anything.
Right.
And so when you look at the combine, I mean, how would you treat this combine? I mean, the Cowboys back in the day when Tex Stram and a lot of these, you know, Cowboys were big in terms of bringing in the, you know, not really the cybermetrics, but they really did some.
You know, the Cowboys, I remember you know, Bob Grady from Beloit.
Yep.
Was a 220 runner in high school. He won a state championship. And, you know, he ended up getting a basketball scholarship to Northwestern. And Bob was a decent football player, but he never played a down in college football. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as a 6'8 center for Northwestern, you know, I think he started by his sophomore year. And he was a decent college basketball player. But the Cowboys looked at Bob and saw a wide receiver and gave him a tryout, even though he didn't play a snap. You know, that's the kind of thing that the Cowboys were doing. They were looking at these guys and going, you know, a guy 6'8" and can run that fast, we're going to give him a tryout. You know, we're going to see. The combines today, though, when you watch what these young people are doing today, I can remember, too, when William Perry was at the combine, and how fascinated the scouts were with his athletic ability. Here's a guy that looked like he never walked past a donut in his life.
Mm-hmm.
And yet he could jump, he could run, you know, and he had a big belly. This cat was jiving off the diving board and doing flips. He was just an athlete. Now almost every one of them young boys are athletes. They have agility. They can jump. They can run faster than, you know, I'm talking about the linemen, you know, D linemen and offensive linemen as well. These guys are just athletes. And so I'm wondering at times if this combine is, you know, ever going to do them justice, because they still, you know, every one of them can play like this now. You know, every one of them would have been as impressive as William Perry back in the day.
Yeah.
You know, when you see these agility drills that these linebackers or these linemen are doing, and so they're just athletes. It's amazing what these guys can do with their size.
Mm-hmm.
And you wonder, too, if they don't have all of these drills down, mm-hmm. and, you know, is it going to really matter when they have to go, you know, toe-to-toe with each other? Because,
you hit something right on the head. But one of the things that just jumped out at me as I was going through this list on Scout Inc., you know, and many people know that, you know, you and I are, you know, I'm located on the border of Wisconsin, and you're in Wisconsin, and, you know, but, you know, we take a national perspective on these things. But I don't know if I've ever seen two Wisconsin Badgers this high in the first round.
Two Wisconsin what?
Two Wisconsin Badgers.
Oh, the linemen?
Yeah, Gabe and JJ. I like, you know, they're both great players, but, like, I just scrolling down here and seeing these two Badgers,
right.
You know, sitting right here, you know, and then you look at a team like UCLA. This is what tells you. Look at a team like UCLA that's kind of on a bounce back. They got two potential prospects.
Right.
You know, and that's what's back to your thing about how this thing becomes so refined that in some ways, you know, I would say today, you know, if you're a good player, whether it's basketball, whatever, you know, between the scouting services and all the information, everything else, they're going to find you. It's
right.
Like when I played growing up, and you could just kind of be under the radar, or if you weren't on the main street, people didn't got it. You could be on the side street, in the alley, you know, and the way that these folks prepare and the setup and the mock, you know, they get with these agents who walk them through a combine-like experience. They
right.
get them all set up. You know, it's like dress rehearsals they do.
They said Dick Butkus, right. when he was, you know, back in the day when they would just, the scouts would just show up, you know, and ask you to do something. And you know, they said Dick Butkus, he, like, would you know, right after his senior year, he would just go practice sprints in his bare feet. he'd just go run a 50 barefoot, because he knew when the scouts came, you know, they were going to ask him to run a 50, and he'd act like it was no big deal. And he'd just kick his hard shoes off, and he'd just say, well, I'll just run it like this. And he'd run a hell of a 50 in bare feet, and the scouts would go, oh, my God, you know, this guy's an animal. He'd been practicing like that. That's, you know, he meant that. You know, he wanted to impress you that way. But they didn't realize that he'd been running 50-yard sprints with no shoes on for the last 3 months. You know, he practiced that way so he could try to impress you that way.
Yeah.
You know, they said that, they said Brett Favre, when he was in college, he used to just kneel at the 40 and throw the football as far as he could. You know, and when the scouts came up to, you know, to give him his workout, that's where they would find it. Well, you know, everybody knew the scouts were coming, so they called on to Brett. So when the scouts walk on the field, he's kneeling at the 40, throwing the ball up into the stands.
Mm-hmm.
So the scouts had to be impressed with that. I mean, what are you doing? Oh, I'm just goofing off. You know, it's probably where the combines came from. They got tired of all that trickery, all that circus shit, and they were like, here, we'll just make up our own stuff. You do what we tell you to do.
Take the Wonder Lick and do all that crazy stuff.
Right. You know,
it's like, we're going to test you. We're going to do everything on here. Like, we're going to know about your family. I guess when you look at the kind of investment they're making in these players, you know, it's probably need that level of scrutiny.
So that was the thing that came too. But what's the kid from Arkansas, the quarterback?
I'm like losing my mind today.
They talked about they at the combine. All the reporters wanted to talk about his drug problems last year.
Yeah,
you know, and that was one of the things that the scout said. You know, here the kid said he didn't want to talk about it. You know, that that was in the past. That was between him and the school. He came back his senior year, had a wonderful year, and you know, pretty much refused to talk about it. And one of the scouts said, you know, this is what the combine is about. This is one of the highest, you know, one of the hardest media presence that this kid will ever face. And he really didn't do well. And it's similar to what he's going to face every week. If he should be drafted by the Giants or should he be drafted by Chicago or anywhere else, where every Sunday you're going to have to go out and you're going to have to talk to the media, whether you like it or not. Yep. It's part of the job. And so it's part of what the scouts are looking at these combines. Not only are they looking at the athletic performance, but they're looking at how this kid's going to handle the pressure of answering questions by sometimes not-so-friendly people. And,
Mallet. I'm, like, losing my mind. Yeah. I know his name better than – but, yeah, I mean, Mallet, yeah, he looked like he struggled a little bit with that, you know, between the team looked in it, on it, you know, either say, look, it was a tough transition, had some tough things I was going through, or say, you know, he's got to have an elevator speech, and I blame that on the agent because those are the things that you got to practice, you know, and you got to be hard on them, and they got to be able to come out, and you got to have your elevator. That's one thing that Cam got down, whether people like it or not, he got his elevator speech down.
Well, that, you know, what impressed the scouts about Cam, you know, was 2 days earlier he talked about himself being an icon and, you know, wanting to be bigger than football and, you know, those other things. And the scouts in the press just, not the scouts, but the press just slayed him for that. You know, he talked about himself in the third person from, you know, about three times. And the press just talked about him. Well, 2 days later, you know, he talked about that. And when he talked about that, he was a hell of a lot more articulate. He realized that, you know, they were concentrating on some of the things that he didn't really want to talk about, or you know, they were emphasizing things that weren't what he was trying to portray. And he came right out and said it in such a polished way that the scout said, "Hey, you know, this kid is sharp. Mm-hmm. You know, he recouped as well as anyone could have in that situation, because they want to, you know, the media wants to rattle you." You know, they want to try to rattle these young guys. And when you can, you know, come back and bounce back, you know, and Cam was one of those players. You know, he just, I made a mistake, and I left you with the idea that I thought I was bigger than the game and, you know, this and that, and it's not what I, you know, intended to say. And, you know, he polished himself up within 3 days, and most young people aren't able to do that.
Well, hey, it sounds like we have a caller who wants to come on in.
Right.
Do we have a caller there?
Here, go. How you doing?
Hey, how you doing? We got a caller in there. Come on in. Who's this and where you from?
From New York City.
Hey. Okay.
My name is Don.
Don. Welcome to the Real Sports Guys.
What city are you guys based out of?
We're out of the Midwest. Near
Chicago.
The border of Wisconsin, Illinois, Chicagoland area.
Okay, cool. Yep. Dealing with some Bulls fans, huh?
Yeah, you're some Bulls fans. So what do you got on your mind? I'm a Pistons fan, to tell you the truth.
Well, your man Chauncey Billups, he's trying to lead my Knicks this year.
That's right. Tell me how you feel about Chauncey.
How do you like that trade?
Well, when our franchise was drowning for the last 10 years, you know, you grab for any rope. So, I mean, it's better basketball. It's better basketball than what was being played for the last
sure.
10 years, but it's still Mike. I'm not sold on D'Antoni at all. He to me, I don't know. The guy's a couple crayons short in the box, but
sure. But are you pleased that Billups was part of the trade?
Oh yeah,
because that's what we were discussing earlier. You know, we understood Melo. We understood that even just the Melo trade, you know, made New York a better team. But that Billups addition,
he's a 34-year-old point guard. He, you know,
sure.
with the high school and the college, he's in the playoffs. He's got a lot of miles on him, and you know, he was hobbling towards the end of the game tonight. He shook it off, but you could tell he's in pain a little bit. And so, you know, there's no question that, you know, his ability to read things on the court and take over a game is there and hit the big shots. But it's between the Dolan and Isaiah Thomas, you know, there's another Detroit connection to the Knicks.
Right. Well, you can't have it all now.
We don't play anything on Isaiah. You know, the crazy thing about it is, you know, what he did with the Continental Basketball Association, and it, you know, he had a pretty good a little run in Toronto. I think his job in for the Pacers was a little underrated. I thought he did an all right job with them, but yeah, everybody forgets how good he was on the court because he made the Knicks he just destroyed. And I gotta say that. But why is Dolan? It seems like Dolan is still talking to him and getting advice from him. Have y'all talked about that in New York?
Oh yeah, it's Isaiah's. You know, well, obviously, you know, they tried to swing the deal past David Stern to say, well, he's going to be the coach at FIU, but he's going to be a consultant for the NBA at the same time. And Stern said no. So you know. Obviously, he was forced to leave kind of due to the sexual harassment lawsuit by, you know, a little bit of pressure there, media pressure. Then there was the call to 911, you know, supposedly what, he was going to commit suicide or something, and then he turned out, he says, oh, it was my daughter who was committing suicide or something, the strange call, you know, so... You know, we could just do a whole hour on Zeke, but his career at Indiana. I still remember, you know, that game, and with Detroit, you know, no question about a Hall of Famer, but the bad boys. But,
go ahead.
I was going to say you brought up the combine. You remember Jeff Ireland last year almost lost his job in Miami. Because he asked the one player about his mama turning tricks on the side. You remember that?
That's right.
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 So, right. That's right. That's right.
It was a big stink in Miami.
That's right. I played out there in Dallas, and that was a big and because they say part of the process is they want to rattle you and see how you react under pressure. And Dez Bryant didn't react very well to that question. I mean, it was. People talk about borderline, but I mean that's what happens in those individual meetings. I mean, people are asking, you know, questions, and they say, "When's the last time you did coke?" And they want to see what your reaction is. So they're pushing buttons on there. I mean, how do you feel about that as an evaluation process?
Well, in a job interview, I mean, this isn't a typical job. First of all, if you're talking about paying, I mean. These guys, I mean, for the money that Dez got, you know, it's not the average, you know, $10 an hour job. So to whom much is given, much is expected. So obviously, you know, if I went and applied for a job at the Gap clothing store, I wouldn't expect them to ask about my parents' history, you know, what my mom and dad do for a living. But if I was, you know, applying to be a CEO where I get $10 million a year, I think, you know, I probably would be asked those character issues. So,
come on.
You know.
VP, you know, when Disney changes hands, you know, that VP, they're not ever going to ask his mom, you know, did your mom turn six? You know, some of them questions.
Oh.
Some of them questions. I mean, you can't go just by, you know, how much money you're willing to pay somebody. Some of the questions, you know, you can't ask. You know, here in Wisconsin, you can't even ask if you're married. You can't ask if you have any kids. You damn sure can't ask if you know, how do you feel about your mom turning tricks? Even if it's not a, you know, everyday job. You got to figure out how to rattle these kids in other ways. And, you know, that's, you know, but it's controversy.
Yeah, and the flip side is, what does that have to do with whether or not they're going to perform for you? That's a big question. Is what does that have to do with whether or not they're going to do what they need to do for you? Because obviously, Dez Bryant had an excellent year last year. So whatever was his mama was doing, it impacted his performance. And so that's an important thing to kind of to think about. You know, that people feel privileged enough to ask you whatever they're going to ask you. Then you got to you got to deal with the reaction, right? So if he jump across and pull the choke move on you like it's free will, then that comes with asking the question.
Well, I think in Don Nelson's case, he deserved it.
But you also wonder if there wasn't some ulterior motives. You know, there may have been a player he truly coveted, and he was simply trying to, you know, beat some of the other personnel aside. You know, maybe not everybody knew that story or heard that story.
Don Nelson came to our Knicks and lasted 3 months and said, "I'm done. I'm retiring." He quit after 3 months in the middle of the season. And he made some excuse about how he's burnt out or he wanted to go with his family. He was done. And then, you know, he surfaced back in Dallas. So I would choke him if I seen him just for doing my Knicks that year. But I guess that's why he went up for the Hall of Fame this year and didn't get in, even with all those wins. He's got the baggage. But anyway.
Well, let me ask you a question. Are you a Giants or you're a Jets fan?
Well, very despondent Jets fan first, Giants second.
Okay. So what
how do you feel about Rex? How do you like Rex?
Yeah.
I'm about had enough of the act, man. The foot fetish videos was like, you know, way over the top. It's just like, what are you doing? You're the head coach of the National Football League in a major market, and you're putting out foot fetish videos on YouTube. I mean, talk about a distraction for your team. And
How did you feel about the whole Favre situation this year, and how much of a distraction was that in New York?
Brett Favre, Jen Sturger?
Yeah.
Oh, God.
I mean,
yeah.
Those kinds of things kept coming and coming out of New York. You know, first it was Favre, and then it was a foot fetish, and, you know.
Inez Sands.
What's that?
We even forgot about the Braylon Edwards drinking and driving.
Yeah.
Because all this other stuff happened. Didn't Braylon get...
Yeah. Yep.
We forgot all about that. That got covered up after
and then the sideline reporter, Inez Sands.
Right.
Where
yeah.
she claimed they made inappropriate comments. Oh, it was just a circus, yeah. But
I mean, did part of that come from all of their exposure this summer?
I tell you, it starts at the top with Mike Tannenbaum. It starts at the top with him, and then comes through Rex and to the whole team. Yeah, there's no. I mean, you look at the opposite camp, Tom Coughlin. I mean, I'm not a fan. I mean, you had guys like Tiki Barber retire early because they said he couldn't handle, you know, dealing with Coughlin because he's such
right.
a drill sergeant. And
right.
I question Coughlin's ability to manage big games as well. But, I mean, that you look at the extreme opposite side, a guy like Coughlin versus a camp like Giants. I think there's a middle ground somewhere, like a Sean Payton or something, you know, New Orleans.
Right.
But even his team is spotted a little bit loose out of control this year what happened in Seattle.
Right. I mean, it just, you know, it just seems that Jets team is too talented to, they're too talented not to be more successful than they are. And when you think about why they're not successful, is part of it because they have to deal with these things every week. Every week somebody seems to put them in the papers. And New York is one of those places that if you do something, you know, that's the reputation you have in the if you're in the Midwest, you know, New York is one of those places that if you don't play well, that media is going to eat you up somehow, you know. And even if they have to come up with foot fetishes and you know, pictures of your junk and
and they made some interesting moves. I mean, they you know they cut what Chris Jenkins, and then who else did they let go of Taylor. So I mean, they made some moves. I mean, you know, I know Chris didn't play from last year, but I mean, I think that was a major issue that they didn't have Jenkins last year. I think, you know, maybe they're looking to replace that size in the middle. But I always felt the Jets, and I said this on the show, next year they're going to be what we thought they were supposed to be, because they're not going to have all of the off-field stuff with the trying to sign Revis. And then you're talking about Sanchez being a year older. That felt like next year they were going to be what everybody thought they should be this year. I thought they were going to be a little bit better by next year. And so I thought people were just kind of – the expectations were a year off for them. But I think Brett did – I mean, Rex didn't help it because he kind of put the gasoline on it and accelerated those expectations. And so, you know, they're going to have to find a way. I mean, he just came to Combine talking about we're going to win the Super Bowl at a time when you don't necessarily need to create that kind of media for yourself. So I can understand why fans would get a little tired with it. You know, his team has performed in some big games in the playoffs. And, you know, we got to see how the story plays out next year. If they don't make it to the AFC Championship, I'm not sure if they need to make it to the Super Bowl, but they got to definitely make it back to the AFC Championship next year for it to be a success.
Sure.
Well,
have the talent to do it. After those first couple games, they just looked like barn burners. You know, we talked about that, you know, throughout the season. About midway through, I thought New York was the elite team in the league.
They were 9-2 at one point or something. Best record in the NFL, yeah.
Yeah, and they just, you know, they sputtered and fell. And of course, you know, they already had the vultures circling. All they had to do was falter a little bit, and then everybody just climbed all over them. But,
we want to definitely thank you for being on with us tonight.
Yeah.
You know, and feel free to join us anytime and talk about that New York market. We love to hear from somebody on the ground. So we're here every Tuesday night at 10. Feel free to jump on with us and be part of Real Sports Guys. We really enjoy it. Thanks for calling in.
All right. I'll check you out. Thank you.
Okay. Yeah.
Yep. All right. Have a good night. Bye.
You too. Yeah, that was nice. I'd like to hear from them guys from New York.
Yep. Oh, yeah, it was a good time. With that. That we got going on. So, you know, as we move into the final slots here, we haven't talked a lot about college basketball. You know, we're moving towards March Madness. You know, I don't know if you have a chance to really catch up on the hoop, what's going on. I mean, number ones have been getting knocked off left and right. And they talk about the Big East taking on 11 teams. We got the Jimmer man out there, BYU. They actually just kicked one of their number three scorer off the team tonight. They announced that was a violation of the honor code at BYU. Davis, I believe his name is their number three scorer, and so that's going to impact BYU going down the stretch. You got the emergence of San Diego State. In the Big Ten, you got Wisconsin, Purdue, and Ohio State is still hanging around at the top. Texas is just in part of it. And that's why I said about Texas, and Marcus and I talked about this. You know, they got all the players that can play any style. The coach is going to get in the way. It is somehow they just underperform against play teams, and you just like, how do they do that? How does Texas not play it? You know, Kansas has been dealing with injury. You know, Duke is kind of consistent, but I don't know if they got enough when it comes to tourney time to deliver. There's a lot going on out there, but I don't know how you feeling about college basketball and you know. As we get ready for tournament play and March Madness, what are your thoughts?
Well, first of all, let's talk a little bit about San Diego State. Because I know you were never a big Fish fan.
What'd you say?
The coach at San Diego State, what's his name?
Yeah. Steve Fisher. Yeah, you know,
yeah.
I loved him. I missed him. Yeah.
I didn't think, yeah. I thought that you weren't a big Fisher fan in Michigan.
I was a big Fisher fan. I wasn't a big Frieder fan, and I was okay with the fact that they got rid of Frieder because I didn't think Frieder could never get him over the top. I love what Fisher did, recruitment. I felt like the investigation that came back, they didn't find that he was negligent. They didn't find anything yet. He got fired, which was ridiculous. I thought he should have retained his job. And that really hurt the program in terms of being advanced forward.
Okay.
You know, I just thought they overreacted on him. And I'm glad to see that he's emerging and coming back and doing well. I was a Fisher fan. I was a big Amica fan. But
okay.
you right on that one. I wasn't a big amateur fan, but
I thought you always thought Fisher's championship was handed to him. You know,
well,
a lot of people felt that way. You know,
no, because I was there when they played Illinois that last game, and Kendall Gill came back, and.
Right.
They put a whooping on Ann Arbor, and I was, you know, I hung out with my good friend of mine, PJ Bowman, who played on the team. Hung out with them, and they were just, you know, they had a pretty good time for the game. But they went out and just put it on Michigan. And, you know, I knew Glenn and some of these other guys, and I was just surprised the way they beat Michigan down. And that was a low point, I would think. And then, you know, Frieder. Gets a job for Arizona State, you know, then Bo comes in and says the Michigan man is going to coach the Michigan team, and then Fisher. And the interesting thing about that, earlier in the season, I met Fisher because I came out there for a game that was televised, and actually it might have been that part of the Illinois game, and you know, he knew the coach at Beloit, who was well-known in the basketball community, president of the Basketball Association, and real nice guy, so we had a really good interaction with it. Where I was always critical about the Fisher teams, not really Fisher, but the way people define the Fab Five versus that championship team at Rice. And I said the best team they ever had at Michigan, the Fab Five was the most well-known, but the best team was that team that won a championship with Rice, all those guys who put, what, 5-6 guys in the NBA. You know,
right.
They, you know, Lloyd Vaught, Terry Mills, I mean, you line it up. And so – I've always appreciated Fisher. I thought, you know, that the Fab Five was an incredible run. But when you rank teams, that Michigan team with Glenn Rice was, I felt like, the best team. And so that's why was my argument that I had with that.
And a lot of people would agree with you on that too. You know, I think that the whole coup with the Fab Five was almost unbelievable, you know, the idea that those players all came together as one, you know, simply to play for Fisher. But, you know, and that just it put the college basketball on its ear for a while. But I just wanted to just talk about it for a minute, you know, and just see how you felt about how he's doing now, because it's almost like a Tartanian you know, situation where, you know, he had such success at such a high level, such a high profile school, and all of a sudden he's showing back up in the tournament with a really, you know, who are they kind of a place. You know,
that's
and
right.
He's taking on players, you know, kind of like Tartadian used to do. You know, how's he finding these cats? You know, where is he digging these guys up from? So,
and I think, yeah, I think he's found his formula out there, and he's benefiting from finding some talent guys who are some late boomers who are going to be with him for 3 or 4 years. You know, in a league, in a system where, you know, teams like Kentucky and all these folks are talented, but they're young. And then
right.
You got some savvy, we saw with Butler, you got some savvy veterans who can play, who are late bloomers. You can outsmart some of these young fellas, even though they might be talented.
And I think, too, you know, when you talk about a Kentucky or you talk about a Duke, you know, the name just, you know, the name, you associate the coach with the team. But it has to be, to me, a much tougher task for a guy like Fisher to put together a ball team and have the success that he's having than Coach K has had in the last 20 years. You know, people are waiting for those Duke letters. They aren't necessarily waiting for those San Jose letters. So, you know what I'm saying? So, it takes a great coaching job to get you know, those players over the hump.
And I think, you know, I think what's most so surprising about this, that even though he wasn't retained at Michigan, the fact that he would have to be at a San Diego State versus, you know, why wasn't he able to land at a Seton Hall or land at a, you know, an Arizona or Oregon State or, you know what I'm saying, you know, or a, you know,
I think what happened there is a lot like Coach, like Tark, you know. The recruiting that he did was too good, you know, and almost seemed too good to be true, that it could be done without violating any NCAA violations. So you're guilty by association when all those talented players show up. But, see, they do it in Kentucky all the time. They do it at Duke all the time. But all of a sudden they're showing up at UNLV, and something must be up, you know. They're doing it at Michigan, something must be up. So it's just funny. And it tainted both of those coaches. Coach Tark was a great coach. Fisher's a great coach. You know.
As we talk about coaches who are redemption, Steve Lavin in St. John's, I think, is a great match, a great mix for him, going to the other coast, you know, after what happened at UCLA and kind of how he just kind of fell out. And then, you know, Selvin is a great analyst for ESPN and now is rejuvenating a program that I always loved St. John's program with Louis Konosaka and all the players that came through there, to be able to see that program get back on the map and see Lavin having these victories. I mean, he's winning some big games with those teams.
And that may be the surprising, you know, situation of this tournament again, kind of, you know, with Butler and the small teams last year. You know, these teams are coming out of nowhere, you know, really. Yeah. And they're going to make some noise in the tournament.
Yeah. When we look at some in our Big Ten country, I mean, looking at Wisconsin and Purdue and Ohio State kind of being those cream of the crop. I mean, Michigan State, have you ever seen a team fall? They were ranked number one in the country, the top two to fall.
Yep.
They felt like an Enron stock. I was like, when they say Dan Gilbert sent them a message just wishing them well, I'm like, Dan Gilbert, you know, the Cleveland coach, wishing you well, you really falling. But you know, I'm like, what's happening with State?
And that's what everybody's asking, you know. That's what everybody's asking. They have been the biggest bunch of underachievers this year. And, you know, you look at a team like Wisconsin, who they weren't really supposed to do anything. And, you know, that Wisconsin-Northwestern game the other night was typical. You know, if you look at the offensive talent on both of those teams, they're probably the same. You know, they're almost a mirror image of each other. Wisconsin is not that gifted offensively, but what makes Wisconsin a decent team is that they play defense. And defense in any given night will give you a chance to win. They showed that against Ohio State. Their defense played well, and then all of a sudden they came up with an offensive game that they seemed to be capable of playing. But, you know, as much as, you know, of a Big Ten fan, you know, that I am, this year, you know, Ohio State really is about the only team that will make anybody else in the country lose sleep over if you're one of the Elite Eight. And sure, it's hard to say what that Elite Eight is going to look like this year. Sure. You know, as much as you hate to see 11 teams coming out of the East, that's really what you're going to have if you're going to have a legitimate tournament. If you're truly going to grab the top 64 teams.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. As we get closer, you know, we get Marcus back in here with us breaking down, you know, maybe we'll begin to break down the brackets. Obviously, you know, we'll have Selection Sunday, and that Tuesday we'll have to break down the brackets, so they're going to have the play-in games coming in pretty quickly. But,
right.
You know, we'll have to look at, you know how we might do that and begin to position some of these games and talk about some of the dark horses and maybe get some guest people coming on with that. Another big move. I mean, we haven't talked much baseball on here, but Greinke coming to the Brewers.
Okay.
You know, we were talking about that. You know, that small market team, you know, finding a window and going for it. I mean, you know, that's the Brewers. You know they got to make a run this year. You know they're not going to be able to hold on to Fielder. You got developments down there with, you know, St. Louis, and you know what's going on with there with the injuries, and you know what are they going to do with Pujols? You got the Yankees looking old, not really making any moves. You know, kind of what's happening in Tampa Bay.
Philly stocked up
a little bit. You know, what are some of your beginning thoughts? As I know you're looking at the fantasy baseball lineup as you get ready for fantasy baseball, but, you know, talk a little baseball for me.
Well, you know, that's, you know, baseball is not my first love, but this is an interesting time of the year, you know. Pitchers and catchers have showed up, and you know, baseball has begun. And you know, when you look at, you know, some of the transactions in the off season and what some of these teams have done to get themselves better, you know, and some of the moves that some of these teams are making, you know, when you look at the situation in Texas where you have God, I can't, now his name slips me, but you know, the fellow wants out, Mr. Young. You know, these things are, it's typical preseason stuff, it's typical, you know, early season training camp stuff. You look at some of the teams and the moves. I still think Philadelphia has positioned themselves before the season's even started to be a team to beat. Boston, of course, with all the money that they spent and the holes that they filled are just looking dangerous. You know, they have a decent pitching staff, and you know, their acquisitions that they've made. It can't be tough to be a GM in Boston or New York or Philly when your owner says go out and get me somebody. You already have one of the largest payrolls in all the sports, and they're still willing to pay more. and it's baseball. I mean, you know, I saw a stat the other day. There are only like four teams that have a winning record for their lifetime, and it's like the Dodgers in New York, the San Francisco in L.A., or the San Francisco Giants, the New York Giants, New York, and I can't think of the fourth team. But you know, baseball is a game of win some, lose some. For a fan, it's hard to watch. I'm a fantasy baseball follower, not so much a baseball follower. I would like to hope that teams can stack up the way that they do.
I think that's one of the challenges baseball's got to figure out is how to create a structure where small market teams can be relevant if you want to spread the love of the game. And, you know, Selig will say we had, I don't know, how many different teams make the playoffs over the last 10 or 15 years, probably more, he said, in any other sport. And, you know, you have the highest, you know, Yankees have been the highest paid, but, you know, how many World Series have they won in the last 10 years?
I'll agree with that, but that's still.
But a team like Milwaukee's got to mortgage their talent. You know, they started with Fielder and Beloit, you know, all the way up through the farm system, and you know he gets a couple good years. I mean, they're just holding on to him by his shoestrings. You know, he should be able to be some way to franchise a Fielder and keep him. In Milwaukee.
Right, and
you're not going to keep everybody, but you want to be able to keep a Fielder.
Well, that's the thing, you know, and it's without some type of salary cap, you know, you'll get a situation like Philly, you know, where you have, you know, five probable starters anywhere else all of a sudden being on one team. So, baseball is hanging on to their nostalgia, you know, because of the truly competitive sports like basketball and football, they've realized that there has to be some kind of spending cap. You know, it doesn't negate the fact that there are some teams that should move or be eliminated. I mean, if you're in a market that you can't fill the stands, that's a problem. But it shouldn't show up on the field. Because, you know, the Yankees still have to play somebody. Boston still has to play somebody. And simply because they're in a small market that can't necessarily generate the revenue to field that kind of a team, you know, it shouldn't show up on the field. New York needs New York needs the small market teams. They need somebody to play. And not just for a 9-0, you know, blowout.
Well, and I think what angers some people and even some of the big markets, the one thing that baseball does have in its revenue sharing is they have a way for these teams to do things, but then you find that teams like Pittsburgh and folks are not spending the money that they give from the revenue sharing on building their teams, but they come up with a formula that allows them to still make money even when they don't fill the stands or put the product out. So
sure.
I think that's where teams like New York and some of these big market teams say, you know, what are we paying for? If we find that you're not really invested in your baseball operations
the kind of revenue sharing that's happening. See, the thing about baseball is that they're only televising X amount of games, you know, on the national market, and then they have their own small markets that they're able to cash in on. And so when a team like Pittsburgh may get $39 million next year or this year or whatever to offset, you know, revenue sharing, and then you have, you know, a team like New York or in the case of Pujols, where he's asking for $300 million, you realize that you might as well keep that money. You know, you might as well just pocket it. Said Diego, even if you do sign him, it's unlikely he's going to show up, but even if you do sign him, that's all you got.
I think well, one of the things about, you know, the war on steroids is doing is, you know, it's allowing it for it to be a speed game and a more athletic game. And there's ways you can build a team around pitching, defense, and that. But now, can you – that allow you to be competitive?
I think the argument needs to be, you know, is it has to be a whole system wide. When you look at teams like Atlanta, who, you know, literally built their teams through their farm systems and kept those players that they nurtured and, you know, signed them and kept them around for a long time. And then when they realized that they were going to win, they were going to sell tickets, they were going to sell hats, you know, kept the nucleus together. You know, there's a model for you. And you know, otherwise, you have teams like the Marlins who have one good year, and then they rest. You know, they start to dismantle before they even get a chance to hold on to the trophy. So, you know, baseball is one of those sports that it's their reputation and nostalgia that holds them together. Baseball will be here forever, and until they have no reason to change what they're doing. You know, they have a fan base, and people will go out and watch them play, regardless of whether it's going to be, you know, the big cities, you know, the Bostons against New Yorks, or the Milwaukees against, you know, the Dodgers. We don't know. They're still going to go out and watch. And small market teams are going to stay small, and they're going to stay not nearly as competitive.
Well, we are down to the last few minutes of the show. I don't know if there's any other topics that you really want to get into that we didn't nestle in or hit on. I think we covered a lot of what Marcus had down, the game changer. In terms of big key items, I think as we look forward, we're going to have this draft coming up in a few weeks. We got the, you know, possible stoppage by the end of the week. We got, NBA beginning to heat up here down the stretch with a lot of these teams getting into shape form. So, you know, we got a lot of, hot topics that going to impact us. But I'll let you kind of send us off. We got about 90 seconds here, Ray. So, you know.
I want to get back to the NFL for a minute.
Okay.
Yeah, I need to go back to the NFL for a minute here and just to remind, you know, folks that this is perhaps the greatest, you know, sport to sit down on any given Sunday and enjoy. You realize that even the worst of teams, still put together a good football game. And I hope that the NFL, you know, gets their shit together and works this out. Nobody's going to miss a meal regardless of what they do. You know, everybody's making money. And I don't believe in an 18-game schedule. And I don't necessarily believe I would give the owners $1 billion unless they open the books and show me they need it. Ever.
As I always say, straight cash, homie. that's a Marcus song. Well, we're gonna kind of shut it out. We're gonna kind of take it on out on this. It's been good. Until next week. For the real sports guys, we look forward to having to join us and talk about the sports next week. So next week, take it out.